listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 25th installment of our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the political economy and history of the USSR. And we've made it up to 1912. We've been sort of inching there in almost real time over the last few weeks from 1905. But we're going to look at the Prague Conference, which took place early that year, where Lenin helped to organize. It was a central figure in organizing. And then Trotsky's attempt at conference in Vienna that ended up with some interesting challenges later in 1912. So why don't we pick it up there?
Great. Good morning. Okay, so the year 1912. What happened in 1912 was of great importance to 1917, as I will try to point out. So in 1912, the sixth all-Russian party, that is the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party conference, was held in Prague in January of 1912. 20 party organizations were represented, and the conference was conducted by Lenin. Now, what was significant and momentous in this conference was that the Bolsheviks constituted themselves as an independent Marxist party, and they called themselves the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, parentheses, Bolsheviks. Okay. Why was this so dramatic? Well, the Mensheviks were expelled from the party, and the formal unity of the Bolsheviks, formal only, that had existed since 1903 with the Mensheviks, was cut forever. So the Prague Conference inaugurated a party of a new type, because before they were a political group. And the new type is what we call Leninism, which is synonymous with the Bolshevik Party.
Right.
All right. So in Marxist archives, they have the history of the Communist Party of Russia, written by the Communist Party of Russia, and they say that the purge of the ranks of the proletarian party of Mensheviks, which was effected at the Prague Conference, had an important and decisive influence on the subsequent development of the party and the revolution. If the Bolsheviks had not expelled the Mensheviks from the party, which they call compromisers, the proletarian party would have been unable in 1917 to rouse the masses for the fight for the dictatorship of the proletariat. We will see, so they say, if they had not expelled the Menshevik, well, we will see why the Menshevik wanted to, would have cooperated and did with the provisional government. And so, now, why was there an urgency to create this separate, independent, Marxist, revolutionary Bolshevik party? Well, because the years after 1905 were very difficult. The difficult conditions brought about by the defeat of the 1905 revolution, the Bolshevik alone remain as a political group who remained faithful to the party program, the Marxist party program. There had been a disintegration of the opposition groups and trends. There had been a disappointment with the revolution. And there had been increasing efforts of intellectuals who had deserted the party, people such as Bogdanov and Bazarov and others. There had been an effort on their part to revise the theoretical foundations of Marxism. Lenin talked about them as Marxist critics in quotation marks. Okay, so we have the years after 1905, where the integrity of the various groups within the Russian Social Democratic Party kind of dispersed. So we have this effect. But by and by, and certainly by 1912 and 13, there was a relaxation of the repression by the Tsarist government. Now, if we look at some figures, we can see what was happening. It is estimated that between October 1905 and April 1906, that's 1905-1906, that's the years of the revolution, 15,000 peasants and workers were hanged or shot, 20,000 injured, and 45,000 sent into exile. So the years after the revolution were marked by a dramatic rise in the numbers of death sentences and executions. For example, if we compare the year 1905, there had been a maximum of 26 executions. But in 1909, at the apex of the repression, there had been 537. These are official executions. By 1912, executions had gotten down to 123 from 537. Hmm. And in 1913, shortly after the January conference, Prague conference, it had gone down to 25. So things had relaxed. These numbers, of course, do not include, summary execution of military mutinies. And also, official statistics excluded execution during punitive expeditions, especially in Siberia, the Caucasus, and the Baltic provinces. By 1906, there were 4,509 political prisoners in Russian Poland, which was 20% of the empire's total. So it had been fierce, and it had dispersed the revolutionary fervor. However, the reaction to the relaxation of repression took several forms within the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. For example, one group, this is relaxation. One group advocated liquidating underground activities and parties and acting in complete legality. They were saying, okay, repression is over, and now we can work with the Duma and with in complete legality. We don't need underground activity. We don't need revolutionary party, in effect. Now, this liquidating underground, those who advocated liquidating were called the liquidators. That's one group. Another group refused to act in legality altogether, and they were called the Otsovits or the Otsovits. The Trotskyites had ostensibly separated themselves from the Mensheviks and were pursuing centrism, a supposed effort at reconciliating Mensheviks and Bolsheviks under the direction of Trotsky. We'll get back to this. Trotsky, so-called non-factionalism. Right. So, as a result of the relaxation, these groups were saying, well, let's stop being underground and printing stuff and, rousing the proletariat, etc. It's just, things are good. Now let's, and some were saying, no, we must continue. We cannot participate in anything. So there were, these things. Now, we will see what the position of Lenin was, which was really strictly classically Marxist. What Lenin wanted eventually at the Prague conference, when we get there, was we operate both in legality and in illegality. We stay underground, but we have some activities that are overground. For instance, we do not oppose representation of delegates, representation of working class and peasant delegates in the Duma.
Right.
They should ask for an 8-hour day work.
Right.
They should ask for a distribution of land. This is perfectly Marxist, because in 1850, Marx said, after the failed 1848 revolution, look, we lost. What we have to do is, yes, ally ourselves with the petty bourgeoisie in some things, but also keep the proletarian and the workers' consciousness and activities in the forefront. We have one culture, and we have to keep it alive, and that's
yep.
the proletarian workers' culture.
Yep.
But at the same time, we've got to move. We've got to ally ourselves with the bourgeoisie in some things, like regaining some of the things we lost.
Right.
Did you want to say something?
No. I'm. I'm following it. I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway. With the repression relaxing, we have this kind of lack of focus, this kind of centripetal, or rather centrifugal force.
Like inertia sets in. It's you had or even a chaos from an inertia trying to settle in on a moving train, because you have conscious effort on the one hand by the Tsar and the entrenched forces inside Russia in the aftermath of 1905. Here's your reforms, and you have representation in the Duma. You have some of these, you know, demands for things like an 8-hour day or whatever are met. That we stop shooting people in the street and such.
Yeah.
And then people kind of demobilize because this, you know, short list of demands starts to get met. But the way things work, of course, they end up, you know, the Tsar ends up, you end up with, for example, a slaughter in a mine that basically was owned by British capital in Siberia. And that gets people back in the street and other things.
Right.
So, yeah, so I just wanted to move
Yeah, you wanted to close. Sure, first you get the fist, and then you get a little, you know, the fist, and then a bit of carrot.
Right.
So, so the fight against the liquidators and the Otsovists, as well as against the Trotskyites or the Trotskyists, confronted the Bolsheviks with the urgent necessity of uniting all the Bolsheviks and forming them into an independent Bolshevik party. This was absolutely essential, not only in order to put an end to the what Lenin called the opportunist trends, which generally means the reformist, the Menshevik, within the party, which were splitting and confusing the working class, but also in order to complete the work of mustering the forces of the working class and preparing it for a new upward swing of the revolution, because at the Prague Congress he said there is a new fervor for it now that the terror has passed. Okay, so now we're at the Prague Conference, and excuse me. So Lenin gave a report, an analysis on the task of the party in the present situation. And he gave this profound analysis of the political situation within the country. And he showed that revolutionary sentiment among the masses was running high. And the conferences emphasized that the task of the conquest of power by the proletariat remain that of a democratic revolution in Russia. Not sure that I can gloss that. So the important thing is to see what he meant about this revolutionary, what was the revolutionary party supposed to do? Lenin never changed, really. Even in 1923, he said that Bolshevism had remained in place as a continuity from 1903 to 1917. Oh. And, of course, he never strayed from what he had written in What Is to Be Done, that the object was to take state power. But the question was only when and under which circumstances. And when it actually happened in 1917 that he said, let's take seize power, it startled everybody, because everybody in the Bolshevik Party itself, because they thought they would have to go through a bourgeois democracy, which they had, you know, since February, at any rate. In Prague, he said that he described the task of the Revolutionary Party. The Revolutionary Party should unite into one inseparable whole the assault on the government in the name of the entire people. The assault on the government. So, violence. This doesn't mean, you know, running blood, but violent overthrow. That is, with armed, not petitions.
Right. And that actually was another point of divergence with Lenin and Trotsky.
Yeah.
Stalin writes that about that period, that Trotsky and the one of the groups that he was associated with that wanted to petition the Duma, got the liquidators, they got 1,300 signatures on a petition for the right to strike, free association, etc. And at the same moment, hundreds of thousands of workers were, you know, in the streets with the signs of the Bolsheviks.
There you go, yes. At the Vienna conference, of course, under the guise of uniting all the factions, he was really promoting the agenda of the liquidators. Mm. And Stalin said so, and so did Lenin.
Yeah, he always had the faction that was talking about factions. You know?
I mean, this group was at each other's throat in no time.
Right.
This unified. Right. How can you unite the liquidators who say we'll act in legitimacy and the Austerlitz who said we will not? You know?
Right. We don't recognize your legitimacy.
Yeah. So the second task is to assume the revolutionary training of the proletariat, revolutionary training, to give them theory.
Right. This is what we were talking about last week, too, when you had, and the week before, you had these different events take place in 1905 that motivated the workers into the streets and, you know, some rather radical responses from the workers because mm-hmm. they had enough. And there was no leadership to say, okay, this is what we do next. And so when the czar and anybody else that wanted to throw at the workers did whatever they would do to them, there was no engagement in a battle. It was like a military struggle with only one side. The other was just fodder because there was no leadership. And so
That was in Moscow in December. That's right.
And so now we're talking about recognizing that condition and building a party that would provide that leadership as we move into the events of 1912, et cetera.
And training of the proletariat and the safeguarding of its political independence, training of the proletariat, because Lenin said, there is no, without revolutionary theory, you cannot have a revolutionary movement.
Right.
So the training is important. Then the party should also provide guidance of the economic struggle, in the economic struggle of the working class, plan action, etc. But should the actions be spontaneous, then so the party should be present during spontaneous conflicts of the masses, which it wasn't in Moscow. You see, this is all learned from
after
1905.
The fact. Right, that's right.
A party should be present during spontaneous conflicts of the masses against their exploiters, so as to bring them into our camp to increase the number of the proletariat, not to scatter them afraid and divided and betrayed. So these were what a revolutionary party was to Lenin, what he meant by Bolshevik party. And he was very clear in his writings. He said, the Bolshevik party, what we call Leninism, he said, the emancipation of the oppressed class is impossible, not only without a violent revolution. Again, we're not talking about fisticuffs. We're talking about removing one class of rule with another.
Right.
But also without the destruction of the apparatus of the state, power, which was created by the ruling class.
Right.
I mean, I don't know whether Marx or Lenin said that the bourgeoisie actually took over the state apparatus of the feudal state, you know, because the bourgeoisie had grown within the feudal state.
That's right.
So some institutions were already there, and they could adapt them to the development of capitalism, but no such thing could happen in a socialist, in a socialist revolution, they would smash them. I mean, you couldn't adapt
right.
the bourgeois state to
no.
the socialist state.
It was developed in antagonism to workers. It's impossible
yeah.
to take control
you lose your base.
Yeah,
that's right. And he goes on. So now here he comes. Now we see how Lenin saw the Mensheviks. He characterizes the Mensheviks' idea of revolution. He writes that the Mensheviks says, first, let the majority of the population, while private property still exists, in other words, we haven't overthrown it. First, let the majority of population, that is the people, while the rule and yoke of capital still exist, let them express themselves in favor of the party of the proletariat. So we wait until the proletariat comes to
right.
the party.
Right.
And only then can and should the party take over. And Lenin continues, so say the petty bourgeois democrats who call themselves socialists, who are in reality the servitors of the bourgeoisie. Now, to this, let's wait until everybody's with us, idea of revolution, Lenin says. We say, let the revolutionary proletariat first overthrow the bourgeoisie, that is a tiny, a rather restricted group of the population. Let them overthrow the bourgeoisie, which is really what happened in 1917,
right.
break the yoke of capital, and smash the bourgeois state apparatus. Then the victorious proletariat will be able rapidly to gain the sympathy and support of the majority of the toiling masses, non-proletarian masses. He's referring here to the peasants, which...
Right.
which, you know, he will consider allies, will make allies of the proletarian.
Right.
What did he say? We'll be able rapidly to gain the sympathy and support of the majority of the toiling non-proletarian masses by satisfying their needs at the expense of the exploiters.
Right.
So once you have power and you can begin to satisfy the needs, you can get ally, then you get the masses.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Masses first, then revolution.
I mean, Lenin says,
no, the vanguard party, which is what it is, will carry out the overthrow of the state and will seize power, and then will gather support by distributing, by improving situation.
Yeah, by serving the people. We'll serve the people and obtain their support.
That's right.
Right.
So it's very, and it's really what Stalin did.
Yeah, you know, when we're thinking, going back just a step for a minute, talking about the question of trying to adapt, you know, the absurdity of the idea of trying to adapt the bourgeois state to the needs of working people. The bourgeois state is essentially constructed as a gun to the head of working people. And if you're going to take it over, it's like someone has a gun to your head, and what you do is put your hand on the trigger, but you still continue to point the gun at your own head.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense, because its purpose was, you know, this other purpose, which is hostile to your interests. And so it is something that has to be smashed. We've got about... 2.5-3 minutes. So, where do you want
Vienna
to go with that?
Just so we can pick it up again. Okay, we're at the Vienna Conference, and it's August 1912. And Lenin and Trotsky, I'll say this in 2.5 minutes, preamble to the Vienna Conference, because we already know that he's going to gather all these groups together. Now, Lenin and Trotsky, contrary to what the Trotskyists maintain, were in bitterest opposition for almost their entire careers. not only before, but also after the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
After 1917, Trotsky and Lenin were in constant conflict over the question of the prospects for socialist construction, how to do it, the question of trade unions, the question of war and peace, and questions of party unity and discipline, all with a grave implication on the maintenance of the proletarian dictatorship in the Soviet Union. They were, it can be documented. Now, the only change came after Lenin's death. So Trotsky had been at war with Lenin over essential points, and that continued, and the change came after Lenin's death. At that time, Trotsky chose to renew his old attack on Leninism under the guise of defending Leninism.
Again, it's,
and,
you know, it's just, that's,
and called it Stalinism.
Right.
Just
that's what he does.
Changed the names.
Yeah, that's the names,
you know,
have been changed to protect the innocent. Well, that's what he does. You know, hi, here's my faction. We're here to fight factionalism. You know, it's
yeah.
And yet people have been doing that. I saw that happen at a radio station in New York that I worked at, where, you know, people came in, broke up this community radio station that had been serving the movement in New York City for decades, essentially accused the people who are actually activists of being factionalists, as they created a faction that was being funded by some business people who were about ready, finally, to steal the signal and use it to sell, like, products, green living products, you know. So, All right, we're going to have to come back to this, all of this next week. We made it at least an overview of 1912 through 1912. We can go back and flesh that out some next week. And I appreciate your time and have been enjoying this again today, as I've been enjoying this whole series a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to World Apart. According to the World Bank, 2018 is expected to be the first year since the financial crisis that the global economy will be operating at or near its full capacity. If things are indeed getting better, why are so few people noticing it? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Ann Kruger, former First Deputy Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund and former Chief Economist at the World Bank. Professor Kruger, it's a great honor to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Pleased to be here.
Now, first of all, let me start with a seemingly unrelated issue. You're visiting Russia right at the time when the United States Department of State listed this country as one of the most dangerous places in the world to visit, together with states like Sudan, Niger, and Pakistan. And the specific recommendation for that group of countries would be to reconsider your travel. Why are you defying the recommendation of the American government?
Well, I'm not even, the report I saw in the newspaper didn't even list Russia in the same category as those others.
They had level three countries.
I thought they had two or three that were listed as really don't go. And this Russia was not.
This would be level four, but Russia is also criticized as a country where harassment and supposedly terrorism ran amok. Pretty much to the same level as in Niger, for example, or in Sudan.
Well, I don't know, but I've been here before, and I think I know enough about the country to think that I'm as safe here as anywhere.
Well, the reason I'm asking about this is because there was a time when the free movement of people, the free movement of capital, the free movement of labor, services, goods, was, if not encouraged by the United States, then ideologically supported. Mm. And I think the Trump administration may be speaking against some of those things, but I wonder if there is more to it than Trump. Do you think this sort of shift from a more global orientation towards a more isolationist, if I may put it that way, orientation, has a structural rather than a political underpinning to it.
Well, there's a lot of debate about that, and different people have different views, and I don't think we fully understand it. Quite clearly, the 2016 election itself was strange in a number of ways, including the fact that there were so many Republican candidates that it made it a very strange choice situation. So I'm not so sure as to what did it. Certainly, Trump and his supporters, or Trump and the people right around him, have awakened, I think, a degree of racism and what have you in the U.S. that is, in my view, terribly unfortunate. And I thought we were past it, as did many others. I think the opinion polls are not showing that much support for it. He has the lowest ratings of anybody after this short a time in the presidency, at least from what I read in the newspapers. So I think that it's an open question, the extent to which this reflects something more fundamental or whether this represents a short-term aberration.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you've been long lamenting the influence of politics on the economy, but I think, particularly in the United States, politics gets to be substituted with security, and there are a lot of security concerns passing for political, or other, the other way around, political concerns passing for security concerns. And when it comes to global trade regulations, there are exceptions for security concerns. Don't you think that this clause of security is running a risk of being abused, that the countries will press those security considerations as a way to get a competitive advantage?
Well, there's no doubt that individual industries will push whatever they can push to try and get whatever special favors they think they want. If I were to worry about protectionism in the United States, I would worry first and foremost about those who are saying, oh, it's the jobs that are at stake, whether they are or not. But a company is not going to say, gee, we're losing money, we want to make money for our shareholders. They're going to say, look, we may have to close the factory and the workers will lose their jobs. And that's a more potent political argument, and it's used. And at least as far as I know this far, the political argument in most cases has been the job loss, whether it's right or not, more than the political. On the political side, there have always been, I think in most countries, some kinds of exceptions for national security reasons. We don't want our secrets known and that kind of stuff. And they're overdone, of course, to some extent in some cases. But I don't think, so far at least, I'm unaware of anybody who saw that that was anywhere nearly as important as the job loss argument.
Well, I will give you one example. My own channel has been, RT has been sanctioned because of its supposed interference in the American political process. And what's interesting about it, I know you don't want to discuss politics, but I think it has an interesting economic implication, because if you limit the way those companies, Twitter, Facebook, those big multinational, multi-trillion dollar companies operate, not only in Russia, but around the world, and if they are seen as pliable to political interests, American political interests, whatever they are, Republican or Democrat, I suspect that that may influence the way the global economy is shaping out, because it's changing at this very moment. Don't you think so?
Well, I certainly agree that there's a risk in that direction. I certainly think the degree to which those things have been called upon is already very risky. I hope that sort of winds up very soon, of course. Whether that could become a more general kind of issue that pushes protection in more directions is a bigger danger. And as I said, I think it comes from other things more than from that.
There's one more proposed sanction that was suggested in relation to Russia, and that was switching off this country of the SWIFT payment system, which I think raised a question about who controls the infrastructure for the global economy. And that scared a lot of people, not only in this country, but also I know in other countries they are now very busy developing alternative solutions. Do you think that question may have an impact on the way global economy develops forward? Who owns those platforms that facilitate global trade?
Well, I think, given my background, you'd expect me to say the obvious answer is to get some international organization, the IMF, in the case of the Swiss system, or the Basel Group or something, controlling those things to a greater degree than they do now. I think the alternative will be unfortunate in the sense that if we then end up with different payment systems, it can create a degree of uncertainty for trade and for service transactions that would be unfortunate for all of us. I think it's a lose-lose situation if we go that way.
You're leading me perfectly to my next question. I thought that this kind of dynamic creates a competition not only over the means of production, but over the means of trade. And we haven't seen that kind of competition before to such an extent. You can essentially take the entire country out of the global system by just pushing the button. And that potentiality is very scary to many people. I know you are not in favor of sanctions in general, but I think also it creates a very interesting way of how effectively those sanctions can be implemented. And my question to you is that we have the Bretton Woods system that was designed to address some of those issues to ensure the non-discriminatory treatment and such. Do you think that system at this day and age is capable of addressing the issues that we are talking about?
Well, the UN, the World Bank, the IMF, everything internationally is sort of subject to what the political will of the owners of the system are. And the owners of the system are the nations of the world. And insofar as they find it in their interest to agree on something, I think they could do it. Whether they will be able to do it, whether their political masters will want them to do it, is the important question, I think. By the way, I don't think that any country can push a button and get rid of trade. It's far too important. There'd be far much too political backlash. Protectionism to a point, unfortunately, perhaps even when it's damaging, yes. But to talk about cutting off trade, I think that is...
But if you ban banking transactions from a certain country, that's effectively what you're doing. Obviously, over time, people will be able to find ways around it. But that delivers such a blow that I think would be very significant for any given country to take.
Money is a very fungible thing. And I think it would be very quick before people found ways around it. Because, as I say, it might be damaging, it might cut it back. But the idea that you could do anything nearly to stop it is very unlikely. I think ways around it would be found very quickly. Just to mention an obvious one, somebody here might find somebody in Canada, and the Canadians could deal with the U.S. and come back. And you can be sure there are many citizens of many countries who'd be willing to play that role.
Well, which may not be such a bad thing after all, because at the end of the day, what we want is a fair system for all. Now, speaking about the Bretton Woods system, the Soviet representatives did attend that conference, so they had it in them to show up at the event, but they did not ratify the final agreements, charging that the institutions that that conference created were the branches of the Wall Street. And I think that is the view that many in Moscow still espouse. You work both at the IMF and the World Bank. Do you agree with this assertion, which is very popular in Moscow, maybe even in Beijing, that the IMF, the World Bank are essentially, serving the pro-Western bias?
Well, I think the outcome, certainly through the first 60 years of the institutions, is that they serve the interests of most of the world. I don't think that you could argue with that one. I mean, we've had enormous economic growth, unheard in the history of mankind. Most countries have benefited by it, some more than others. Those who opened up more benefited more than those less. I think that's unquestionable. So I don't think that it's a question of that. Certainly the United States was very dominant in its creation. It was, after all, the only large country that emerged reasonably prosperous right after the Second World War. And in that sense, it had an enormous role in setting up the system that worked as well as it did. But in any event, how long that will continue and how much it can be after all the U.S., quote, preeminence has gone down. I don't think it's gone, but it's certainly less than it was. Other countries have a bigger say, and they need to exercise it there. But I still think there's a world interest, and I served in both institutions. I am an American citizen. At no point did the Americans ever come to me and say, they knew I was an international civil servant. I knew I was an international civil servant. They had an executive director, just as Russia does, and the executive director was responsible for representing the U.S. interests.
Well, Professor Kugel, let's take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Anne Kruger, former first deputy managing director of the International Monetary Fund and former chief economist for the World Bank. Professor Kruger, one of the issues that was prominent at the time that the Bretton Woods system was created, which seems to be pretty divisive today, is the issue of trade deficits and surpluses. The United States has been on both sides of the debate, running a surplus before, I believe, the 1970s, now running a $500 billion yearly deficit. Is that a problem that has a solution at this point of time?
Well, first off, I don't think anybody worries. They should not worry about trade. They should, if they want to worry about anything, it's probably current account deficits, which includes trade in goods and services. And the distinction is especially important right now because the world's share, the share of the world's output that's in services is increasing. It's growing much more rapidly than trade. And trade in services is
and
growing.
And the American services are growing, too. They are exactly. not in deficit.
And it's a mistake. The second point to be made is that, by definition, the difference between a country's current account purchases and its current account sales is the difference between its domestic savings and investment. And current account deficit can be a very healthy thing if you're a rapidly growing economy, if you need more and can productively use more investment than you have domestic savings. South Korea, for example, in the 1960s had a savings rate, I don't know, 5 or 6% of GDP, and its investment rate was 20%. And it was borrowing the rest, but it was growing so fast it wasn't a problem because it had many productive uses. When that happens, it's fine. But either way, it is not a problem for the world, it's a problem for the country. Now, if you get the exchange rate very wrong, which is where the IMF comes in, the chances are it's come about because of domestic measures that tip this imbalance between savings and investment, and then the IMF comes into both parts of it, but the important part is the domestic balance.
But from just absolute figures, they seem to be stunning in the case of the United States. And it is often said that this trade performance is a reflection of the disequilibrium of the whole global economy, as well as disbalances within the American economy domestically. I guess what I'm asking is whether this disequilibrium has already become an equilibrium of sorts that may stay in place and that the addressing of which may create more problems than it solves.
I was going to graduate school in the 1960s at the time when there was dollar shortage. And when all economist discussions and all news discussions were of the U.S. dollar shortage and how other countries didn't have enough and how that was a permanent equilibrium. Now we're on the other side of the coin, and I have no doubt that just about when everybody is convinced of it, it will change yet again. The American economy is in disequilibrium. Its savings are not as great as its investments. And so there is a problem there, and the United States needs to take measures. And the tax reform bill, as I understand, from what I've seen of it and what we can understand of it so far, will make things worse, not better in that regard, as I doubt. But there is that. On the other hand, there's another side to that, and that's the other countries. Now, the Chinese have gone some way to rebalancing their economy away from so many exports, and that's probably healthy for the world economy. The United States and some other countries in Europe need to do the same thing on the other side, or one side or the other. But on the other hand, the disequilibrium so far is not that terrible, and there is still some time.
Speaking about the dollar, the United States derives a lot of benefits from the U.S. dollar being the top reserve currency, but it also makes American goods and services more expensive and ultimately sustains this trade imbalance. If you had to choose one or the other, what would you prefer? And can you really choose? Can you fine-tune your economic policy to an extent when you can have a desired outcome without the side effects? For example, aiming for increased domestic production without strengthening your currency.
Well, right now the United States economy is at very full employment, and the only way to get increased production without a lot of inflation will be to get a greater rate of increase of productivity. So the idea that you could do it through policy measures that would, for example, print more money or cut taxes will not work, have more government expenditures will not work except to be inflationary pressures and maybe in the very short run a little bit, but the long run consequences would be unfortunate. So I don't think it's a question of choice. Over the longer run, the question has to be how do you balance? And the real worry, I think, for the Western European countries, for Japan, for China, for the United States, maybe for Russia, but I haven't looked at the numbers, is that most of us are facing increasing costs of pensions for the elderly, increasing health care costs because of the elderly, many of which fall on the public purse. And unless there are measures taken to cut fiscal expenditures or raise tax revenue somehow, we are all facing bigger problems and will be global disequilibrium, not one or two countries.
Now, you mentioned the issue of savings, and I think this is another factor that sustains the current pattern of the American spending, that people are encouraged to spend more than they earn, that there is not a very established tradition of saving up money. Putting aside Trump and his policies, which I suppose you are not a great fan of, do you think any American administration at this point can actively promote policies that would encourage people to spend less and to save more?
Well, saving more, I think, is the more hopeful policy than the spending less.
And that doesn't one presuppose another?
Not necessarily. There are measures, for example, where you could indeed raise tax revenues in such a way that you cut the fiscal imbalance, and that's cutting the deficit. So no, it doesn't need to be all on the one side or the other. There may be things on both sides, and that's a choice variable. There's no quite a question about that. I think the question, the real choice is not the one you made, that you suggested. The real choice is whether we do something, we, the U.S., do something in the near term to start correcting the imbalance, or whether we wait until it's even more pressing and we have to take more drastic measures.
Now, there are many truisms in economic science, and one of them is that markets and economy likes predictability. Now, I think we would agree that the Trump administration is possibly not the most predictable, but the economy, the American economy, is doing fairly well, for which Trump is eagerly taking credit. Do you think it's doing so well because of him or despite him?
Well, the economy was picking up before he came into office, and all the 20th century, as far as, and probably further back. What's happening to the economy this year is not a function only of policies this year, but in the past. There was momentum for the upturn ahead of time. There's no doubt about that. And we were already on the path to recovery. And certainly nothing that happened in, let's say, the first 6 months of this year could very reasonably be attributed to that. Secondly, monetary policy, which is the responsibility of the Federal Reserve, is outside the control of the president. We want it independent, and it is reasonably so, so that again is not. Probably there is a little bit of an uptick in the stock market, or more of an uptick in the stock market because of what the tax law and a few things like that. But on the other hand, I think there are concerns over the longer term. At the moment, the markets seem to be very euphoric, and they don't seem to be looking at what's ahead, but I think there are reasons to be a little more cautious than that.
Now, I don't know if you would agree with me, but I think the American economy, especially like the starting of history of the American economy, poses a very interesting philosophical question of when your biggest weaknesses or biggest strengths trade places. So when your biggest weaknesses become your strengths, or vice versa. And the American economy in that sense is unique, I think, in both its exposure and its reliance on the rest of the world. And I wonder if you believe that it can still be treated as a purely national economy. Should it be approached as an economy of one country, or whether larger considerations always have to come into place?
Well, I think that all of us, perhaps somewhat more small economies than large ones, but all of us have to take into account the international repercussions of what we do, because we are interdependent, which is, I mean, the history of mankind is getting more and more interdependent, not just the past 100 years, despite what some people say, but Marco Polo already was increasing interdependence way back when, and it's been going on ever since, and even before that.
Well, but I don't mean sort of beg thy neighbor policies, not taking advantage of your neighbor. But I think what's interesting about the United States is that when Trump appeared on the scene with his slogan, putting America first, it was very difficult for me to explain to my Russian friends what he means, because in many countries, you're supposed to do that anyway. You're not making that into your election slogan. This is something that is presumed you will not be voted in
otherwise. We were putting America first with the old policies, and we are not with the new policies, because I think the biggest losers, if those are carried through from what he said, are going to be the Americans.
But how would you balance those national interests and the interests of international, multinational companies, which I still think have a certain influence, perhaps bigger than expected on the American decision
making? Maybe in some political ways they do, but strictly on economic grounds. In the longer term, I think there is no way that the kinds of protectionist measures that the president has advocated, if they come to be, will be in the American interest in the longer term. There will be a few people who may keep into your jobs a few days or a few months longer. Although even there, a lot of that is ephemeral. We had the occasion, I think it was last week or the week before, where Walmart announced they were going to do something with raise the minimum wage to $11 an hour, which probably they had to do anyway. And then the next day they announced they were laying off, I forgot, 1,000 people over here. So that, you know, they're saying they announced the one thing with great fanfare, the other thing comes out in a little footnote, oh, by the way. And, of course, people announce the things that they think. But I do think in the case of the kinds of protectionist measures that the Trump administration has so far advocated, if they come into being, or to the extent that they do, they are negatives for the entire American economy. And probably they're negatives for the world in two ways. One, of course, the world gets a little bit hurt when they could have exported more. But two, unfortunately, that is also giving aid aid and comfort to protectionists in other countries who will seize. And look, the United States hurt us, therefore give us protection
well,
too.
Speaking
but
about
that's part of what the harm of the U.S. will be. Yes.
Speaking about such protectionist countries, I think Russia could easily qualify. The need for structural reforms in this country has long been recognized, but for just as long they have been sort of put off until a more opportune moment. You published extensively on policy reforms in developing and transitioning countries. Have you developed any sense, any intuition on how to identify that right moment?
I don't think you do identify it. It comes, and normally it comes as a surprise. And in the countries where there has been at least a significant group of interests, let me put it that way, who have had a good plan, sort of sitting there waiting to be adopted. They have, in some of those countries, they've been able to do very well when the time came. And a risk comes when, in fact, you don't have anything ready, and then anybody who comes in with a plan, the leader who's under crisis conditions and so on, seizes it, and it may be counterproductive, and it may not be. So I don't think it's a matter of recognizing it. I think it's a matter of being ready and having, and in the meantime, trying to avoid things that make things worse.
You're also famous for coining the term rent-seeking. I think Russia is especially prone to that kind of business and economic dynamic for all sorts of historic, political, and other reasons. What do you think it takes to make that change from seeking rent into more forward-looking, perhaps more risky, but wealth-generating, new wealth-generating
Well, I don't know the Russian economy that well, but I do know there's lots of oil and gas. And that is both good and bad because it can lead to an economy where you, so to speak, sit happily on what your good fortune of having it instead of using it productively in other activities. And at least from the outside and based on what I know, the Russian economy has not successfully transitioned to a reliance for growth on things other than the oil and the gas as much as I would have thought a good reform would. And I think convincing people of that would, in my guess, be the way to go because there is a future, I'm convinced, for Russia as everybody else, that does not depend on just sitting on those rents.
Well, I wonder if the United States is actually lending a helping hand in that persuasion work because you know that there is a new round of sanctions to be targeted sanctions to be introduced against powerful Russian individuals. And I think in Russia, it is a problem. We have a problem of privileged access and rent seeking when certain individuals, well-connected individuals, just sit on their pots and enjoy the status quo, perhaps limiting opportunities for everybody else. Do you think the American sanctions could provide some silver lining in that sense of sort of spurning the powers that be towards?
I don't know enough either about. I haven't followed that closely. What the Americans are talking about in the last year, there have been so many statements coming out from the administration that you don't know which ones to follow and which not to. And so I tend to wait until they do things rather than look at what they say they'll do. The second thing is I don't know enough here as to know what's going on. But what I do know is that a level playing field where the new startup, where the guy who's got something going wants to go further, when he's treated the same way as the big guys, is the important part of getting the growth going. And I just don't know how much that is. My impression, actually, in the 1990s, once the Commonwealth of Independent States started, that there was a time when there was a lot of sort of new grass shoots coming up and things looked reasonably good, and that not that much of that has happened in the past 10 years or so, which tells me that maybe the small guy has more trouble than the last guy getting a hold of the resources he needs and so on, but I don't know that.
Well, Professor Kruger, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate your time. And to our viewers, please keep the conversation going on our social media pages. And I hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.